All right, show of hands. What do you think Apple ought to do? Help the FBI or not so much? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday it is, the 17th of February. Great as always to have you with us, everybody. Not just no, but heck no. That was Apple CEO Tim Cook's response early this morning to a federal court order requiring Apple to help the FBI get into an iPhone used by the San Bernardino shooters last year. Cook said in a letter to Apple customers that while he and the company were shocked by the attacks, quote, "We oppose this order, which has implications far beyond the legal case at hand," end quote. There's also a business case here. Molly Wood is our senior tech correspondent. We called her up to talk this whole thing over. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so give me real quick what it is that the court wants Apple to do here.
Right. So the short version is they've got this iPhone and they can't unlock it. They don't know the passcode. And if you enter the wrong passcode too many times on a phone, it will lock up and erase all the data. That is a security feature when a phone is stolen. What they want Apple to do basically is write software that will bypass that security feature so that they can, you know, just keep trying passwords all the live long day until they eventually unlock the phone.
Right. And then the FBI is confident it can figure out the encryption within, yeah?
Exactly. Okay. But they haven't said for sure that they won't then come back and say, hey, while we're in here, can you also go ahead and unlock the encryption?
Right. Fair enough. Okay. Tim Cook is a businessman. He runs a multi-bajillion dollar company. He is now and has been for years selling this encryption and security as a feature, not a bug. It is a point of business for him. Yeah?
It absolutely is. I think that Apple, you know, a few years back, like you said, really decided that they were going to create the privacy platform. And this is also a personal issue for Tim Cook. He is an activist on this issue. But they said, we want to create that trust with our users. There have been high profile breaches. We want to be the platform you can trust. And they want to keep selling iPhones with that intact. They don't want to become AT&T, who helped the NSA spy on millions, or Yahoo, who helped jail a Chinese dissident. Right. They want to say, you can trust us to protect your information.
Well, speaking of the Chinese and the Russians and any other country you can think of, what do you suppose is to stop them from going to Apple if the court is successful in this and saying, hey, you gave it up to the Fed, you got to give it up to us?
Yeah, that's a huge part of the concern. You know, nobody knows what kind of legal precedent would be created. It isn't the kind of thing where the government could necessarily come back at that and say, look, you did it once, now you are mandated to do it over and over, but it's certainly a slippery slope. And one of the outstanding questions is, let's say Apple caves and they unlock this one phone this one time and somehow manage to call back that security and the FBI doesn't make a copy of that code.
Yeah.
What happens next time? And what happens when China wants that? And I think that is part of the reason that Tim Cook feels very firmly that he needs to stay strong on this.
One more thing and then I'll let you go. Did I miss the press releases from Google and Facebook and Twitter sticking up for Tim Cook and Apple here or what?
Yeah, that's so weird. I guess those got, you know, locked and sucked up in the email vortex somehow. Not a word. And privacy advocates are absolutely all, including Edward Snowden, are already calling on Google and other companies to back them up here because these are companies that haven't been, you know, Google is allowing users to enable strong encryption on their phones, but they haven't drawn this bright line in quite the same way that Apple has.
I'll see you in court, I think, is Apple's line here. Molly Wood, our senior tech correspondent. Thank you, Molly.
My pleasure, Kai.
We take you now from the latest in modern technology straight back to the financial crisis and the never, it seems, going to end question of whether the big banks, here it comes, are too big to fail. Our entry today comes to us from an unexpected source. Neel Kashkari ran the Troubled Asset Relief Program, the TARP, that bailout that helped stabilize Wall Street back in 08, as I'm sure you remember. Kashkari now runs the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, and in his first speech in that office yesterday, he said there is still a risk that if the big banks fail, the economy could tank, and that financial reforms to handle that risk haven't gone far enough. Marketplace's Annie Baxter wraps it all up for us from the other Twin City, St. Paul.
Some of the earliest alarms about banks getting so big that their failure would harm the economy came from Minneapolis Fed officials well before the financial crisis. And when Neel Kashkari took over as Minneapolis Fed president, he found banking regulators there were still worried.
And some of them said, you know, we think too big to fail is still an issue. And I already had that view.
Now Kashkari and his team are going to gather input on how to address big bank risks and announce a plan later this year. Kashkari says post-financial crisis reforms have left banks in better shape, especially in terms of the financial cushion they now keep in the event of problems. But he says they remain so big and interconnected that one failure could still have a domino effect.
My concern is if there's a stressed economic environment with broader weaknesses, if regulators let that one bank fail, that could then trigger contagion to other banks.
I think he's very late to the party here.
Tony Fratto used to work with Kashkari at the Treasury Department. He says some of the ideas Kashkari is looking at have already been considered and dismissed, like regulating banks as utilities. Fratto says that would restrict some of their activities, like trading, to an extreme degree.
They just want to eliminate anything that doesn't have to do with plain vanilla-style banking.
Fratto says shrinking big banks could actually hurt the economy by making credit more expensive. But Neil Kashkari says that kind of risk is worth considering given the potential costs of another financial crisis. In St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Annie Baxter from Marketplace.
The Fed released the minutes from its most recent meeting today. There was a fair amount of worry about global risk to the downside last month, to quote the Fed. Quoting the markets today, Fed? What Fed? The happy music when we get there. British Prime Minister David Cameron heads to Brussels tomorrow. Beer and chocolate? Sadly, no. The leader of the second biggest economy in the European Union is going to be wrangling concessions from the EU, or trying to anyway, trying to get Britain more say over things like migration and financial policy. A looser union, if you will. The stakes here are not small. Later this year, the Brits are going to vote in a referendum on whether or not to stay in the EU. Our European correspondent Stephen Beard has been testing the waters in the port city of Dover on Britain's southeast coast, just 21 miles from the continent.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Not far from Dover's famous white cliffs, in a bitingly cold wind, an open-air service of remembrance is underway.
We gather here to worship God and to remember those who sacrificed their lives during Operation Fuller some 74 years ago.
Operation Fuller was an heroic but doomed mission off this coast during the Second World War. Six canvas-covered British biplanes took on the might of the German Navy and were shot to pieces. Today's remembrance, says local pub landlord David Little, is a timely reminder.
We had many hundreds of thousands of men who made the ultimate sacrifice in laying down their lives defending our country. They were defending our sovereignty.
And that, says Little, a former parliamentary candidate for the UK Independence Party, is what he and fellow opponents of EU membership are also trying to do.
We're not at the moment laying down our lives, but people like myself feel very strongly about self-determination, passing our own laws and being independent from the European Union.
But local supporters of the EU drew a very different moral from the Operation Fuller memorial service. Lawyer and member of the pro-European Liberal Democrat Party, Anthony Hook, says it underlines the EU's finest achievement.
What the European Union has done is to abolish war in Europe. We're now at a point where war in Europe is inconceivable and human rights are safeguarded all over Europe. And that's something we really need to protect.
A car ferry looms out of the fog in the English Channel. Dover is the busiest passenger port in the world. 16 million travellers pass through every year, and more than 2 million trucks. This city calls itself the gateway to Europe. But there are plenty of people here who want to slam the door shut on EU membership. Daphne Duggan and William Burgess fret about other European citizens having the right to come and settle in Britain. How would you vote, in or out?
Out. Definitely. You have all these immigrants coming in. I have nothing against them. It's just that there's too many. We're only a small island.
Would you vote in or out?
I would vote out. It will bring power back to our government, hopefully.
To control the border?
Absolutely. It's too many people.
But others, like Terry Sutton, a local historian and a Freeman of Dover, are more worried about the economic repercussions if Britain votes out.
I'm definitely going to vote staying in. It seems madness to think of coming out.
Madness? Why?
Dover does very well out of the European community. If we came out, they might put back tariffs and therefore there'd be less work for Dover Docks.
At his pub, the Dog Inn, landlord David Little claims that the EU wouldn't dare slap tariffs on British goods. The Brits import much more from continental Europe than they export there. The EU's unlikely to hamper cross-channel trade. It would be business as usual.
We absolutely love Europeans. We want them to come here and spend their money. We want to go there and buy their cheese and their wine and their food. We want to trade with them. What we don't want is unelected commissioners in Brussels passing our laws.
There'll be bluebirds over.
This wartime song helped turn the White Cliffs of Dover into a beacon of freedom and hope. There was no doubt what that meant in the dark days of World War II. But today, black and white shades into grey. Dover is divided, and both sides in the EU argument claim that freedom and hope are their aim. In Dover, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
You can call them cold water shrimp or pink shrimp, northern shrimp. You can call them anything you like, actually. But it's probably been a good couple of years since you've enjoyed sweet Maine shrimp. Maine shrimp stocks are officially considered collapsed, and so for a third straight year, regulators have shut that fishery down. But some fishermen up there are catching a limited amount, all in the name of science. Carolyn Losnick has the story from Portland, Maine.
There's going to be a battle on the auction for these things today.
George Parr, a fish wholesaler, is getting ready to buy Maine shrimp at the Portland Fish Exchange, a seafood auction.
They're still bearing eggs, which is a good thing because while they're still bearing eggs, they're sweeter. Once they've spawned out, the meat becomes very soft and not as desirable.
The shrimp are still alive, and wholesale buyers like Parr are paying more than double what they paid last year.
Say when, $6.50.
During the last commercial shrimp season, dealers paid on average less than $2 a pound. This year, it's more than $8. Today, every last shrimp gets snatched up at the auction in 5 minutes.
Even as good as the shrimp are, it's still a stupid price for shrimp. Oh, I got the bid at 8:20.
Hours earlier, Marshall Alexander caught this shrimp on his trawler, the DD May 2. Alexander has been a fisherman for more than 50 years. And even though Maine shrimp fishery is closed for the third straight season, he's catching shrimp, but not nearly as much as he once did.
They want to manage by letting a certain percentage of them make sure they spawn before we catch them.
Alexander is one of six fishermen participating in a government research program this winter that allows a limited catch in the Gulf of Maine. Fishermen are required to collect a few small samples each day they fish as part of the program. And this is the part of the research that is creating quite a buzz. The fishermen are allowed to sell the part of their catch that doesn't go to the lab.
We wanted them to be able to catch something as compensation.
That's Maggie Hunter, a biologist at Maine's Department of Marine Resources, who is managing the study.
So we're paying them in shrimp, basically. So we hope that they catch enough to, you know, to make the trip worthwhile for them.
The total haul of shrimp from the program, which runs until early April, will only be about 6% of what Maine fishermen caught the last time they had a season. But Hunter says it's important to get data every year.
Well, we're collecting the samples mainly to measure the shrimp and count how many eggs they're carrying and to determine the timing of the egg hatch.
Before the closures, shrimp seasons lasted a lot longer. The harvests were worth $6.5 million 6 years ago. So Hunter says the program's significance goes beyond just the research.
I think it's good to keep shrimp in the news and to keep a few on the market for some lucky people to be able to eat.
Almost half of today's catch goes to an out-of-state buyer who sells it to sushi bars in Boston and New York. But some of the catch stays closer to home.
It doesn't last more than a day, even with the prices being skyrocketed.
That's Connor Vincent, an employee at Harbor Fish Market in Portland. And not far away, at 4th Street Restaurant, owner and head chef Sam Hayward hopes to score some too.
We love them. It's one of those things that expresses delicious Maine seafood in the winter when many other seafood products aren't available to us.
And customers do ask about the shrimp.
We love them and we remember them. We want them back. Are you going to be bringing them in?
To which he always says,
nobody wishes we could get them more than we do. There's nothing that will really quite equal Maine shrimp's place in our communities and on our tables.
But even with limited fishing, scientists say they are concerned. The Gulf of Maine has been warming over the past decade, creating an inhospitable environment for the creatures. From Portland, Maine, I'm Caroline Losnick for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I'm in shape to chase around a 2.5-year-old, and but that's kind of the extent of it. I don't think I'm ready for NHL game shape.
I got nothing to say on that. You're going to have to wait to hear the story. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 257 points today, 1.6%, closed at 16,453. The NASDAQ up 98 points, 2.2%, 4534. The S&P 500 climbed 31 points, 1.6%, 1926. TransUnion, the credit report company, reported a profit for the last quarter and issued a strong forecast for the year. Its Wall Street score shot up 17%. Competitors Equifax up 2.6%, Experian up 3% today. Google is the latest tech company to laugh at the ghost of WebVan and get into the business of delivering groceries. Yeah, so we got search engines, self-driving cars. Now in parts of San Francisco and Los Angeles, heads of lettuce, I suppose. Alphabet, a.k.a. the aforementioned Google, up 2%. Bond prices down. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.81%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The islands of the South China Sea are some of the most argued over dots of land on the whole planet. And on one of them, China has apparently placed surface-to-air missiles. Beijing has controlled this particular dot of land for about 60 years. It says the missiles have been there 4 years, a contention not everybody agrees with. But back to the South China Sea here for a second. Why all the hubbub in the first place? Marketplace's Sabri Benishour is on that one.
The South China Sea is basically a legal and diplomatic brawl.
Disputed by China, Taiwan, Vietnam, Malaysia, the Philippines, and Brunei.
Gregory Poling directs the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative. There is money involved. Fishing, for example. China sometimes imposes fishing bans in the overfished sea, which other states ignore.
And that usually leads to a lot of run-ins with Vietnamese fishermen, many of which end up violently. Ships being sunk when they were rammed by Chinese vessels. In at least one case, a Chinese Coast Guard ship lit a Vietnamese fishing boat on fire with flares.
There's some oil in the South China Sea, too. But ultimately, this is not about money.
The economic explanations are not very convincing.
Sarah Oliver is a research analyst at the Peterson Institute.
Most of the major oil reserves are in places that aren't actually disputed territory.
And the fishing?
Not in the great scheme of things, all that valuable.
James Kreska is a professor at the U.S. Naval War College. This ultimately is about military and strategic dominance for China.
It's about a strategic posture. They would like to have a free hand in Asia generally.
For the U.S., it's also about international laws and preventing China from rewriting them. Again, Gregory Poling from the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative.
The U.N. Convention on the Law of the Sea and the system of maritime law underlying it would not survive an acceptance of Chinese claims.
The South China Sea is one conflict that can't be boiled down to money. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Secretary of State John Kerry was out here in L.A. yesterday, had a big meeting with the heads of the major Hollywood studios, he did, about fighting ISIS. On the face of it, an unusual negotiation for America's top diplomat, but there is actually a long history of these kinds of conversations between Hollywood and Washington. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports.
ISIS is gaining followers in part by telling a compelling story, especially online. The U.S. wants to undercut ISIS, so it's turning to master storytellers. Rick Stengel, Undersecretary for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs, was in the meeting.
We want to get Hollywood involved. I mean, there's nobody better in the world at storytelling
than Hollywood.
So you had studio execs and diplomats all bouncing ideas on how to put a message out that'll cut off support for ISIS. Every administration does something like this. George W. Bush advisor Karl Rove met with Hollywood execs after 9/11. In World War II, collaboration went well beyond brainstorming. Historian Catherine Kramer Brownell remembers the patriotic short films airing before movies that were often paid for by studios.
Shorts, 3 to 5 minutes. Reels that would talk about why you should pay your income taxes. Others would tell about you need to buy war bonds.
Some of this is Hollywood bosses wanting to do what they can to take down a nasty enemy. Hitler then, ISIS now. But they're running businesses, too. Being helpful to the government could mean a more favorable hearing for their views down the road. Marty Kaplan, now at USC, previously worked in both worlds as a Disney exec and a White House speechwriter.
What Hollywood cares about are things like copyright, piracy, and every other way to protect its revenue stream.
Global business issues also came up in the meeting with Secretary Kerry. And sitting there with the studio execs was Chris Dodd, Hollywood's top lobbyist. Hollywood loves a fight against a villain. If going after it helps the bottom line, even better. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
There's a little-known rule in the National Hockey League, little-known outside the sport, I suppose, that lets teams whose goaltenders have been hurt, they carry two, so if one goes down, they need a backup. Anyway, teams can call emergency backups, older guys or guys who maybe played in college, to put on the pads. Nathan Schoenfeld, bank manager by day, got the call on Monday from the Arizona Coyotes. Nathan, it's good to speak with you.
You too. Thanks for having me.
So tell me what happened when the Coyotes called. What were you doing when the phone rang?
I was at home with my wife. We have twin boys that are 5 weeks old, and we were giving them a bath. And we have a 2.5-year-old as well that was running around. So we were handling all three when I got the call that I was needed. Luckily, traffic was pretty good on Monday with it being a holiday. So we got there just in time to get ready for the game.
When was the last time you actually played competitive hockey?
Competitively, it was probably 10 years ago. Since I've played in university for Arizona State, and that was the last time I've played real competitively.
Are you in shape? I mean, you're what, like 31 something?
31, yeah. I'd say I'm in shape to chase around a 2.5-year-old, and but that's kind of the extent of it. I don't think I'm ready for NHL game shape.
Were you sitting there the whole time going, please don't get hurt, please don't get hurt, please don't get hurt, please don't get hurt?
Yeah, oh yeah, for sure. You're just hoping things go smoothly. And I have practiced with a team before, so I'd have been not comfortable, but maybe ready to take a couple shots. Yeah, I don't know how ready I would have been to play if needed, though.
How often does this happen? Do you know, like, around the league that they call some random dude from the community?
It happened one other time this year, but it was a little different. It was during the game, and so the guy, it was in Minnesota. He sat in the locker room for the third period, but he never went out to the ice.
Wow.
To actually be able to sit on the bench for the whole game, I don't know when the last time something like that has happened.
Do you have a connection to the team? What's your connection to the Coyotes?
I do. So my father-in-law actually works for the team as the equipment manager. He's the one who gave me the initial text. And my dad had worked as a head coach in the late 90s for the team as well.
Uh-huh.
So I have some connections. I know some of the players pretty well. Most of them really well after the last couple of days.
Yeah,
but I have a little bit of a tie-in from before as well.
Yeah. Did you get paid for this? You must have gotten paid, right?
I don't know. I mean, that's kind of the question going around right now. Even the players in the locker room were asking what my check was going to look like. But I think I'm going to get a jersey out of it, some pictures, and lots of memories. So if there's an actual check involved, it'd be a nice little bonus. But so far, I'm pretty happy with everything we've gotten.
I bet. Are you a hero now at the bank down there?
Yeah, everyone's gotten a kick out of it. There's been articles passed around in emails, and you know, we've been Googling my name, which is weird to say, but you know,
articles
keep popping up. So everyone's getting a kick out of it for sure.
Nathan, thanks very much. Good luck to you.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks.
This final note on the way out today, in which we announced the relocation of Marketplace World headquarters to Paris, France. I kid. I don't get to decide those kinds of things. But boy, if I did. They're talking about a new law over there letting people ignore their work emails, like legally, totally legally, while they're off the clock. There was a labor union that had that in their negotiations in Paris a couple of years ago. Didn't really work out all that well, as you might imagine, us being human beings and all. So, yeah, I guess we'll stay in L.A. Yeah. Hey, look at that. We got to go. The Dow up 257 points today, 1.6%. The NASDAQ added 98 points, about 2.2%. The S&P 531 points higher at the bell, 1.6%. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APN.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.